Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hey, this is Kat, Communications Director of HRN, here with a preview of Episode 2 of Meat and 3. This week, we're talking pork. We'll learn the best way to make a BLT.
I don't think I've ever successfully made a BLT just because I eat the bacon before any other part.
How pitmasters and restaurateurs are helping put small-scale pig farmers back to work in Alabama.
It's all about money. That's the bottom line.
What pork has to do with economics?
Farmers could be particularly affected by China's threat to levy its own tariffs on pork and soybeans.
And with government.
Basically, all of politics is pork at this point.
So tune in on Friday afternoon for your weekly serving of Meat and Three, and make sure you subscribe to be the first to know when new episodes air.
Thank you, Dave. Hey, it's Monday. It's 12 o'clock, actually 12:01, and this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we're going to talk about water. A few months ago, I happened upon a piece, I think in AgriPulse, which is one of the many trades that I follow, and it was about a Kansas town called Pretty Prairie, where the people have sort of acceded to the fact that their drinking water has been polluted by agricultural runoff. But for various reasons, which will be soon revealed to you, they have elected to sort of do nothing about it, and they just drink bottled water and they don't complain. So to talk more, I was so fascinated by this because, of course, you know, we've all been following the story in Flint, and then I've covered on the show here a lot the water quality issues in Des Moines, Iowa, with Bill Stowe, who was trying to to force agricultural communities upstream to clean up their act, and that was not a success. So it was interesting to see that here's a town that has just kind of like said, okay, this is the way it is. And so Elizabeth Royte, who is the author most recently of Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It, along with her previous books, Garbage Land on the Secret Trail of Trash, and The Tapir's Morning Bath, Solving the Mysteries of the Tropical Rainforest, which were all named New York Times Notable Best Books of the Year in 2005 and 2001. Anyway, she has also written on science and the environment for Harper's, which is where this article appeared that we're going to discuss today, on National Geographic, the New York Times Magazine, Outside, and other national publications. She is a frequent contributor to the New York Times Book Review and a contributing editor at Smithsonian, On Earth, and the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, which I support assiduously on my show because I just think they do amazing work. But anyway, Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate your presence here.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, this is such an interesting story. So let's name it. It's called Drinking Problems. Very nice title, by the way. I wish I could think of titles like that. Drinking Problems, a Kansas town confronts a tap water crisis. It was in Harper's a couple months ago. Is that right?
It's in the May issue.
Oh, May issue. Okay. So tell us about the story and what got you interested in it.
Well, I'd been writing about water issues for some time, in a big way with the book you mentioned, Bottle Mania,
yeah,
which is about how we became a nation of bottled water drinkers and what's wrong with tap water and bottled water, or what's right with them. And so that brought me to looking at municipal water supplies. And I'd written about agricultural pollution a couple of years ago in the Central Valley, looking at nitrates from cow manure and fertilizer.
Uh-huh.
And then I became aware of the Pretty Prairie situation. I don't know if it was from AgriPulse or from Circle of Blue, which is this great news service that's affiliated with the Pacific Institute in California. But the town has such a great name. It stuck with me, Pretty Prairie, and I had read about their very high nitrate levels. So I wanted to look into what was going on in this town, and thanks to support from FERN, the Food and Environment Reporting Network, I went out there to take a closer look last fall.
Uh-huh. And let's talk about, so their water is heavily polluted with nitrates, which are coming from agricultural chemical applications on fields and running off into their water table. What are the health impacts of drinking nitrate-laced water?
Well, it's a great question. It's, at the root of all of this, the EPA has set a standard of 10 milligrams per liter in the water. Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of evidence that drinking water at levels higher than 10 parts per million will hurt infants or fetuses. And it's closely associated with a blue baby syndrome.
Yeah.
It inhibits blood cells' ability to move oxygen to the brain. Babies turn blue. You rush them to the doctor. Not so many babies die of it, and it's really rarely diagnosed these days because most public water systems do a great job of keeping the nitrates lower than 10. But it's a little bit uncertain what the effects on adults are of high nitrate water. And there have been contradictory studies that show, they contradict each other. Mm-hmm. Some show that high nitrates are linked with thyroid disorders or diseases or colorectal cancers or stomach cancers.
Mm.
But the problem is that it's really hard to look at people's diets and say how much nitrate is coming from their water and how much is coming from food.
Mm.
Because 80 to 90% of the nitrate that most people consume does come from vegetables, like dark leafy greens and beets. So it's really hard to separate where nitrates are coming from.
Right. But I would think that in a town that has, you know, the incredibly, it was like 20 parts per million as opposed to 10, which is the regulation.
Right.
That was the level in Pretty Prairie.
And higher.
And 22, higher.
23 was the highest that I saw.
So there's that population, and then there's also the Des Moines population that could be studied in this way because of the very, I mean, I think their nitrate levels were even higher.
Well,
in
they
the
were
Raccoon
high
River.
In the source water, but there's a fantastic utility there,
right.
The Des Moines Water Works, that installed expensive equipment to lower the nitrates to below the federal drinking standard. So
right.
If you're a customer of the utility, you're drinking water that is safe as far as nitrates go.
Right, that's true. That's
yeah,
true.
So
you wouldn't
Prairie
be able to see that.
System. First, we should say this town has like 300 water meters. There's a population of around 640 people,
yeah.
And they drink groundwater. It's pulled up from wells, and it's chlorinated, and other additives are put in to keep pipes from leaching metals and lead into the water. but they were not doing anything to remove the nitrates, and Des Moines has deionizing, I'm sorry, I'm blanking now,
it's
on
okay.
The system that removes the nitrates, locks them up.
Yeah. Reverse osmosis?
No, they have the ion exchange program.
Oh, right,
the
right.
Treat equipment in Des Moines, not reverse osmosis. That mm-hmm. is what Pretty Prairie ultimately decided to go with, is reverse osmosis, which is more expensive. And it hasn't been built yet, but they're heading that way.
Well, you reported that the town has kind of been in the crosshairs of the Environmental Protection Agency for several decades because of that, because of their high nitrate levels. But now the people in the town have an opportunity to have those regulations kind of defanged by the current administrator, Mr. Pruitt.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what they want? I mean, you know, they all, like in your story, it said, you know, people were saying, well, I've been drinking this water for years. I've never had any problems. I don't see it as an issue. Like, you know, this is just government intervention that's not necessary and unwanted.
Right.
I mean,
so there's a couple things going on. So the town, it's 93% of the farmland in this county is rural. They're, you know, everyone's a farmer or knows a farmer. And a lot of people had grown up on farms that had much higher nitrate levels. They drank from wells and they were surrounded by, you know, they lived on dairy farms or whatever.
Yeah.
So there's this bedrock belief that it was okay to drink water with high nitrate levels. They did not want the government hassling them in Pretty Prairie and telling them they had to spend all this money to build a plant.
Right.
And the State Department of Health allowed the town to get away with this for quite some time by providing bottled water to the most vulnerable population, and that was to the babies. And so mm-hmm. there's only like 6 babies born in Pretty Prairie a year, and if you're a mom or a dad of a baby, you could go down to the town hall, which doubles as the library, and you would get for free bottled water for the family. So
right.
Nursing mothers would use the bottled water, or pregnant women or infants themselves, if they were
mm-hmm.
drinking formula, you could use this free bottled water. So the people in town thought that was basically okay, and they were protecting the most vulnerable. But then as the levels of nitrates got higher and higher over the years, the Department of Health cracked down a bit and asked them to study various solutions to the problem. But they really, they dragged this on for more than 25 years.
Wow. So what were some of the solutions?
So, bottled water, first of all.
Right, which doesn't hardly seems like a solution, but okay.
Yeah. Bottled water for I think anyone who wanted it could get it, but it was only the, the people with the little babies who took advantage of that. And that, cost the town $40 a month. Mm-hmm. Another solution that they tried was drilling a new well. They did various studies to find groundwater that had lower nitrate levels, and they found an area that had only 2 parts per million, and so they switched the town system to that well. But over the months and years that they drew from the well, the nitrate levels went up to 9 and then higher. So that was not a solution. What other towns do sometimes when they have different sources of drinking water, they blend a low nitrate source with a high nitrate source to get a final mix that's less than 10 parts per million.
Mm-hmm.
And another solution that Pretty Prairie looked into is what's called consolidation, when you build a pipe to a town that has much better water and you buy water from them. And Pretty Prairie looked at their neighbor Kingman, which is 10 or 12 miles away, and they ultimately decided not to do that. They didn't want to, there was some cost to them, but they didn't want to be subject to any water rate hikes that town could impose in the future.
Sure.
They wanted to be independent. Then at one point they came up with the idea of an ion exchange plant, the same system that Des Moines uses, and it was going to cost them $800,000, and they were going to get a grant to help build it. And then they studied what happens. There's a waste product when you use this system, and they had no reliable place to dump the brine I can't remember the name of what you have to dump afterwards. You've got these chemicals
like
lined up with each other, and then you have to dispose of them. In Des Moines, they put them back into the river where they got them from, but Pretty Prairie doesn't have a source like that. They would have had to go into the landfill, and they were not clear on what impact that would have and how much it would cost them, so they scotched that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ended up with this plan to build a reverse osmosis plant, which is expensive and energy-intensive. And as I said, they haven't started building it yet, but are supposed to soon.
Isn't reverse osmosis also the project or the process that you use to desalinate water?
Yeah. You use a lot of energy, and you force water through tiny, tiny holes through membranes. Yeah.
Wow. And so that was like over $1 million, if I recall, from your article.
$4 million.
And let's remind the listener that this is a town of, less than 700 people. There's 300 ratepayers, as you called it, meter payers. So how those people are supposed to come up with, what would that be like? $3,000 no, more than that.
They ended up getting a $600,000 grant from the feds, and they got a $2.4 million loan from the state. So that's like a low-interest loan. And they've raised their water rates already, and they're going to raise them again. But they're still not among the highest-rate communities in the country. They're still paying medium sort of rates.
Mm-hmm.
But, to put it in perspective, the annual budget of this town is less than $1 million. So they're going to be paying off this loan for a very, very long time.
Yeah. I mean, that's a burden.
Yeah.
For clean water.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes you want, there are water, you've written a lot about water. So water, we're going to go off on a little tangent here. Water regulations seem to be like a very fluid, forgive the a very fluid set of regulations across the country. It's like every state has different regs kind of about who can access what water and how much, I guess. And certainly the EPA's regulations about how many parts per million of nitrates is, how did they determine that was the number?
First, let me correct you. All the states have to follow the federal law, the Safe Drinking Water Act. So the feds set the levels of contaminants that be in the water, and they also tell the states what they must test for. So we're all we all have the same standards to meet.
Okay.
And
thank
bottled
you.
Water is similar, but has different requirements on transparency and how often they test and things like that. But let's just talk about public water supplies for now. So how did they come up with this standard?
Yeah.
There was evidence. So the standard wasn't set until the 70s, and there was strong evidence that high nitrate level was linked with blue baby syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And usually the EPA determines a safe level, and then they add a multiplier factor, like they times it by 100 and make the safe level 100 times the times, or I'm a little fuzzy on this because I reported this a while ago, but they put in a big margin of error.
So yeah.
They're overprotective. But some people complain that this standard of 10 parts per million isn't tight enough and that they allowed no safety margin in this. And other people think that the standard, like, of course, people in Pretty Prairie think 10 parts per million is too tight and it should be allowable to have 15 or 20 parts because there's not enough evidence that it harms adults.
Right.
You can't have a two-tiered standard. That's the problem. If there is evidence that it hurts babies, you can't say babies should have safe water, but everyone else can drink something else because, you know, utilities are monopolies. People don't choose their public water provider, and you have to have water that protects the most vulnerable.
Wow. It's, you know, on the one, you know, obviously it makes perfect sense. The Clean Water Act is a great piece of legislation. But when you look at the impacts on a small town like this, you really are, I'm kind of scratching my head. Like, obviously these residents are not going to feel like they really should have to pay for a water quality plant fix that they don't feel that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And how do the residents feel about having their water polluted by their farming neighbors? I mean, I guess you covered that before when you said, like, everybody knows a farmer is a farmer. I mean,
right.
What do the farmers do? I mean, aren't they concerned about this? Like, what
so
solutions
most of the
can they adopt?
The farmers, it's really interesting. Pretty Prairie covers about half a square mile, and the farms are what surrounds it. And those people on the farms are not drinking from the town supply. So the farmers feel like we're making a crop here. We've got great yields. We're feeding America.
Yeah.
They're exporting huge amounts of grain, and they can't do that without putting nitrogen on the fields.
Right.
So one thing, they're not paying for this reverse osmosis plant. Their water rates aren't going up because they drink from private wells on their own property.
Right.
And many of them, they may have high nitrate levels in their wells, but they don't seem too concerned, or if they are, they probably put in a reverse osmosis system under their sink and protect themselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
The people in town who are bridle against these higher rates, they don't like the higher rates, but they kind of throw up their hands and say, what can you do? The feds are making us do this, and they're not going to change the farmers' ways. The farmers are their friends, they're their neighbors, and they, you know, at the center of town is a grain elevator and a fertilizer companies down the road, and their whole economic vitality is based on high yields and the farmers doing well.
Right,
which keeps the community afloat.
Mm. Wow. This is a problem that is probably replicated all across the Corn Belt. Am I right? I mean, they cannot be the only town suffering from this same problem.
No, there's the Environmental Working Group has a great database on contaminants in drinking water, and they've identified 150-something towns, very small towns in farming communities with these super high nitrate levels, and they're mostly in Kansas and Texas, Oklahoma, and a little bit in California.
Well, Kansas, as we know, it's my favorite. It's my hobby horse. Like when Sam Brownback was the governor there, I tried to do a little feature on him almost every week to show how absolutely abjectly the trickle down theory of economics was failing the state. So I can imagine that high tech solutions would not be something that the state would even be all that interested in funding necessarily. Or certainly, let me rephrase that question.
Okay.
So they applied for a state or a federal grant to help build this plant?
A federal grant.
Okay. So now, in the Republican model, aren't you not supposed to have money come from the federal government. It's supposed to be all states.
Yeah, but I know that the USDA has, there have been suggested cutbacks and a whole restructuring of the Rural Development Department of mm-hmm. the USDA, and I'm not sure that this has all come through, because they did, when they first applied for this grant to build the plant, they were allowed to apply for only $500,000, and then they made a mistake on the application. Mm. Everything got put off by a year, and when they reapplied, they were eligible for $600,000. Mm. So that was surprising to me. The budget hasn't been cut yet, but there are fears that that Trump's wishes will come true.
And, yeah.
And we know that EPA budgets have been cut back. There's fewer Absolutely. People out there inspecting and doing the work and telling these towns how they could be better protecting their water. Mm-hmm. But you noted that the government won't want to spend the money on fixing the plants, but we have to talk about another solution to this problem, which is the upstream solution of reducing the amount of nitrogen that leaches into groundwater and surface water.
Yeah.
Farms.
Well, you wrote the story. I mean, you followed the Bill Stowe story and the Des Moines, you know, him suing the upriver counties. I did like 3 or 4 programs with him on this story because
yeah.
I thought it was so interesting. But he sued, for people who haven't tuned into those shows or into this story, Bill Stowe was, as Elizabeth said, the guy who ran the Des Moines Water Works. And when the water became so polluted that his aging machinery could no longer keep up with cleaning it and he didn't have money to buy a new one, he decided to take the radical step of suing the upriver counties to force them to improve their tile drainage so that there wasn't so much pollution leaching into the ground, into the Rocky River, the Raccoon River, and what was there was 2 rivers involved. But anyway, and then that case was thrown out of court, shockingly. Well, maybe not so shockingly. But so that was his solution. But how, I mean, are the, so to go back to the farmers in Pretty Prairie, how open are they to the idea of improving their stewardship of the land when it comes to applying nitrates?
Part of a consent decree, in these 25 years, the town was warned about its nitrate levels, and part of a consent decree with the state was that they would do various things, and they would be allowed to serve water that was 15 parts per million if they studied the issue, if they looked at alternatives, and if they formed a groundwater protection committee.
Uh-huh.
And this groundwater protection squad asked farmers to be more conservative with their use of fertilizer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask the farmers, they'll say yes, that they use less, but many of them use less over a larger area. It's unclear how much nitrogen fertilizer use has declined there because, but I wrote another piece for National Geographic about farmers in Iowa who are being leaned on much more heavily than the Kansas farmers to decrease the nitrogen loss from their fields because Iowa is a huge contributor of nitrates. Nitrogen to the dead zone in the Gulf.
Right,
Kansas
right.
is too, but Iowa's much more culpable. And so cover crops were a big part of the answer, or proposed answer in Iowa and Kansas. Farmers, as I wrote in the Nat Geo story, are using saturated buffers and restoring oxbows and planting prairie strips and all these tools that farmers can use to stop nitrogen from running off their fields. But it's a bit different situation in Kansas. The soils are different. The geology is different. But what people are asking Kansas farmers to do, and what I talk about in the Harper story, is just planting cover crops. And something like 1% of Kansas farmers use cover crops.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a lot of reasons why it's not a big deal there. Cover crops cost money. The seed costs money.
Yep.
Planting the cover crops is expensive to, you know, run your tractors over the fields.
Yeah.
A lot of fuel, and then you have to go over your fields again to terminate the crop or
flatten it or whatever you do to
get rid of the cover crop so you can plant your cash crop.
Yeah.
So it's never really caught on in the way that it has in some other places.
Huh.
Although it hasn't caught on like wildfire across the country. Nationally, only 3% of farmland is cover cropped.
And that's just that is something that will have to change.
Yeah.
That's something that's got to go into the farm bill. It seems to me that farmers must be incentivized to grow cover crops and to, you know, create ways of buffering their land from groundwater. So,
right.
I mean, you know, that's something where the federal government, I think, really does play a role. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, the farming community is, you know, and I mean this with complete respect, but I mean, they're not interested in having the government in their business.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, I think Bill Stowe doesn't think that we should incentivize farmers any more than we already do. He says, like, farmers in Iowa get $1 billion a year, and
yeah.
they should pay for these conservation practices themselves. But there is help out there, and the feds do offer, like, $25 an acre for first-time cover croppers. But farmers say it's not enough money, and it doesn't cover it year after year, and... they don't have time to put these crops in and get them out in time.
Right.
One thing I talk about in the story is this time crunch. As the weather is changing, fields don't always, with these intense storms, fields get really soggy, and equipment these days is huge. It weighs a lot, and farmers can't bring the machines out onto their fields until the land is sufficiently dried out. So
there's
a window of opportunity for harvesting the cash crop and getting the cover crop in, and then on the other end, terminating and starting the new one is very much crunched down.
Yes, I've heard that also.
That's so interesting.
It is. It's a real conundrum. I mean, I'm not sure what the answer is there, but I know there is one, in that, you know, extension schools and land-grant universities, you know, if they're not studying up on this, they really need to.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think a lot of communities, a lot of land-grant universities are obliged to study what they're funded for by companies, you know, agrochemical companies. But
right.
that's another story.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about those, because one of the things that you point out is that maybe it was in the blue circle of blue, but the operating systems that clean the water actually require very sophisticated technical skills, apparently, and technicians who would have to move to someplace like Pretty Prairie in order to operate these machines. So how is that going to be affected?
Well, Pretty Prairie has two part-time maintenance workers. I met them, and they're the ones who grab water samples, and
mm-hmm.
they also do road repair. And they said that if the plant got built, that they would go for more training, and they have to get some advanced certificates,
mm-hmm.
and that they would stay in town, that they were from the town, and that would be their new job. So there'll be more training, and they'll probably have to. They will deserve higher salaries. So,
yeah,
operating these plants is not cheap. But I guess the point I was making is that other small towns have had trouble attracting skilled technicians to run these plants. People don't want to live in tiny little towns.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I get that.
Yeah.
I'm from a small town.
No, I mean, Pretty Prairie is wonderful. I'm not saying, like, what you know what I'm saying.
I do.
It's not for everyone, but for this. I don't know. People in Pretty Prairie were amazing, and that's one of the things that impressed me was their propensity for sticking around through thick and thin. They loved their hometown,
right.
and if they went away to college or they went away for a job, they came back, and they were buried in their hometown cemetery, and there's a lot of...
Yeah, no, it's history. It's your history.
Feeling.
I get that. I wouldn't want to leave it if I were my... You know, I wouldn't necessarily want to move there, but I also wouldn't want to leave. I would love to, you know... It's where your roots are.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you need to be. I get that. You know, what's interesting is that it seems like, you know, more non-farmers are up in arms about about water quality issues than farming communities. And I find that an interesting disconnect as well. You know, I would think that farming communities and farmers especially would be very upset and concerned about water quality issues because, I mean, in the end, when you pollute water... You know, even if it's something that appears benign, like nitrates, you know, there are other chemicals, agrochemicals, that are going into these groundwater facilities in towns like that. And especially, as you said, in Iowa, which is not only a big grain producing state, but also a huge state for pork. And so there's lots and lots of pollution from pork farms. And, you know, it's different. It's, you know, E. coli pollution. It's, you know, it's other stuff, particulate matter. And people are just, kind of baffled by the complacency of farmers about that just being okay. You know, they live in these communities. It's not okay to do this.
Well, it depends on geography, I think, some of it. And farmers who don't see the impact immediately, if their wells are okay and the water is flowing downstream, they don't really worry about what's happening one state away in their reservoir that they drink from, that maybe is having these hazardous algal blooms because of farm runoff, or they're not linking their farm with what's going on in the Gulf of Mexico. But I have read about farms who drink from wells that are contaminated with E. coli or with nitrates from their neighbors or even themselves. And, you know, when it hits home, when it's your own well and your family, or even your livestock. In Iowa, I heard about some pig farmers who had high mortality among piglets because of they linked it with the nitrate levels.
Oh, so blue baby syndrome in piglets.
Yeah.
Which would make total sense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, given our close proximity to their anatomy.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating, Elizabeth. Really interesting. How much money do you think the nation's utilities are spending on cleaning up water supplies that are polluted by agrochemicals and agriculture?
The USDA did a report in 2011, and they said that utilities were spending $4.8 billion to remove nitrates. But that number, it's old, and it's really low because there's much more attention paid to nitrates now. There's more nitrates on the land and in the water, and that has to be removed. So I spoke to people who thought that it was well over $5 billion a year.
Yowzer. That's really shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come right back with Elizabeth Royte. She is a writer for most recently Harper's, and we're talking about clean water in Kansas. Stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're talking today with Elizabeth Royte. She wrote a story called Drinking Problems, which I love that title. You're so smart. Drinking Problems. No, take credit for it. Come on. I'm not interviewing the editor. A Kansas town confronts a tap water crisis, and that is in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. It was sort of co-sponsored, I suppose, by the Food and Environment Reporting Network. Is that how you guys work that? Like they pay you part and Harper's pays you part, or they place it, or?
Yes, they supported me while I researched the story to see if it was actually a worthwhile story, and then they helped supplement the fee that Harper's pays.
Oh my God, how wonderful.
Otherwise, you can't do these long, deeply reported pieces for the rates that many magazines want to pay these
days. Oh, no kidding. I wrote a 2,000-word article for a you know, a publication I admire and I like a lot. I will not name it here, and my fee was $400. Took me 2 months to write it. Yeah, because I'm not, and unlike you, I'm not actually a natural writer. It's really, really hard for me. I find it, you know, it's agonizing. I don't do it very often, but I had a good story idea. Anyway, never mind. Enough about me. Let's talk about you, Elizabeth. Let's talk about, like solutions to this. So if no one opts to clean up either their act in applying fertilizer or paying for building the expensive plants to clean the water, you know, what's the outcome going to be about over that when it comes to water shortages, when water becomes more scarce or is so polluted it can't be, you know, really used in anything but sort of gray water applications?
I can't imagine that we would get to that point because,
really?
I mean, you can't live without clean water. And we do have federal standards. We have rules and they need to be more tightly enforced. I mean, we saw what happened in Flint and so many other small towns. The amount of there is no pure water out there. But towns just can't exist without water. So, this is just a theoretical exercise. But a town would people would move away. I mean, I suppose you could keep farming, and the farms could be worked by robots.
Yeah.
But people can't live in a town without clean water,
right.
And businesses can't operate. And I suppose you'd have more and more people fighting over ever smaller supplies of decent water. But we're not going to get to that point. We know how to prevent nitrogen from running off fields into the water, and we do know how to take it out on the back end.
Right.
For much more money. So.
So that drives up the cost of food. And then the other thing that I visualize with water is I see more and more corporations buying up water rights and then, putting in the money but selling the water to townsfolks in a way that is not as equitable as it is today. I mean, many people pay water rates already. But
Are you talking about water transfers, buying up like farmers' water rights?
Yeah, for stuff like that. Yeah. Well, or just buying up, say, like Nestle decides to go into, you know, Pretty Prairie and say, I'm gonna buy up your water, I'm gonna clean your water, and then I'm gonna sell it back to you, at a certain rate. I mean, I wonder if we're heading in that direction just because of, for instance, in the case of Pretty Prairie, they just don't have the money to do this. Nor do they have really the political will, but mostly they don't have the money.
Well, they're doing it, and their water rates will reflect it, to some extent. But that's interesting. Like Nestle could go in there,
but it wouldn't
be spring water because they don't have springs there. It would be groundwater, and then they would filter the bejesus out of it and call it Nestle Pure Life.
Yeah.
And
I mean, you're the bottled water girl. I mean, this shouldn't be
it would be incredibly expensive for people, and they'd move away to a place where, you know, you can buy 1,000 gallons of water for pennies, like, you know, most good-sized cities in the U.S. It's pretty cheap to drink your 8 glasses a day. Whatever.
Yeah.
Tap water.
I don't know. I see a time coming when there was a story not long ago. Of course, I'm only off on a tangent here. You'll have to forgive me. I saw a story not long ago about, you know, Nestle acquiring the right to pump even more water out of a town in Michigan.
Yes.
And I'm sure you saw that, too. And it got me off on a train of thinking, like, of how, you know, how eventually, you know, towns, without even realizing it, could find themselves having, you know, given away their water for a quick economic boost and then kind of living to rue that day 10 years down the road. And I'm wondering if that's sort of the scenario we are creeping toward even now, just because of problems like the one that you describe in your story about Pretty Prairie. Because eventually, you know, towns are not going to be able to keep up with having to clean their water in order to drink it.
If they can't keep up with cleaning it, they're not going to be able to keep up with buying little plastic bottles of water.
Well, that's why I'm thinking that a big company would come in, and then they wouldn't be buying little plastic bottles of water. It would just be coming through a plant that was monetized by them paying rates that are far more capitalist than they are now, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, we're off on a silly tangent here. I'm sorry. It's just like futurizing.
Yeah, this is a theory that some anti-water privatization groups have floated. But I've never delved too deeply into that scenario and how that might happen. I do worry more about bottlers coming in, collecting water. You know, they monitor flows and they know how much towns use and how much they want. And
right.
But they don't always take into consideration the needs of the environment and what nature needs.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that every gallon is replaced naturally and they're only taking extra water. But to me, I feel like there is no extra water in nature.
That yeah.
It all goes somewhere for
for a reason.
For a reason and a use. And,
yes, I feel the same way. Well, I'm very much with those anti-privatization people.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but I mean, I the idea that water will eventually be controlled by, you know, people like Warren Buffett or Nestle or something like that is absolutely terrifying to me.
Right.
But
Idiocracy.
Yeah.
And what was it called? Brawny, the water that came out of the taps. Everyone irrigated their fields with the privately owned product.
I do not know that story. That's great.
You have to see that movie.
Yeah. I obviously do. I had one more thing I wanted to float by you about this. So you were saying earlier that there are ways to mediate, nitrogen runoff. And we talked about cover crops and buffer strips and prairie strips and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And how much they cost the average farmer. So I just wanted to revisit that concept for a second. And in the context of the farm bill, because I'm asking everybody what they think about what the farm bill should contain. And do you see any progress towards, well, I know Bill Stowe said people shouldn't be incentivized, but like the farmers in Pretty Prairie, how rich are they? You know, how big are their farms?
You can never ask a farmer how rich they are, you know? They don't even want to tell you how many acres they have. and they're all, you know, they say the farm economy sucks now. They've produced so much grain that the prices have dropped pretty low.
Yeah.
And there's giant stockpiles of wheat from harvested in 2016 that are waiting to be sold while they continue to grow more and more
right.
wheat. And, you know, with the trade talks ongoing, they don't know what they'll be able to export. So things are very uncertain. The farmers there have, I talked to farmers who have between 1,000 and 3,500 acres. I'm sure there's bigger landowners
yes.
out there. I don't know. They all get subsidies. I checked some of their names in the databases, and of course, they're all getting farm subsidies.
All right, so then they should freaking pay for this. There's no excuse. I mean, I always think of, like, the smaller farmers, you know, like the guys that I know in Rhode Island or whatever, you know, they have a few hundred acres, and you want to talk about tight margins.
Yeah.
But the guys with the 300 and, you know, 3,500 acres who are selling, I mean, it's hard to make a buck on grains right now, but you know,
right.
they do get the subsidies, as you said.
Right.
So, well, Elizabeth, the time has come for you to promote yourself shamelessly. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is a good discussion.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Really good.
Yeah.
So you have a website. Tell me where it is.
Oh, it's just royte.com, my last name, royte.com.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see some of my recent work. For shameless promotion, I'll say I have a story in National Geographic for June. Most of the issue is devoted to plastics, marine plastics,
plastic
pollution. And I have a piece in there about the potential health impacts of microplastics in seafood.
Yeah.
That's my bit of it, but
Uh-oh.
It's a really cool issue. kind of heartbreaking. But
yeah.
That out. And then a couple other stories. And I'm headed to Boulder in mid-August for a 9-month fellowship at the University of Colorado. So I'm going to be out of
congratulations.
Yeah, out of the magazine writing game for a little while.
That might be a relief.
Yeah.
What are you going to be doing on the fellowship?
Taking classes, going to seminars, and looking at some of the impacts of the Trump administration on public lands.
Yeah. That's going to be good. Well, we didn't really talk enough about Pruitt and the fact that, you know, when we were talking about the EPA regulations and the Clean Water Act, it's not a sure bet that those will survive this administration, would you say?
No, right. The waters of the U.S. is still in limbo, but it could lead to a whole lot more pollution in drinking water supplies.
Yeah. Well, stay tuned, folks, because I'm sure Elizabeth will be writing more about that subject after her fellowship. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
And thanks so much. And this story, should you choose to read it, is in the May issue of Harper's. And then you've got the great story coming up on microplastics in fish in June in National Geographic, right?
Yes.
They're really doing some great work. I love Nat Geo. All right, my dear. Thank you so much for this. Thank you to my sponsor, Wisconsin Cheese. And thanks, as always, to my mighty engineer, David Tatasciore. And see you next week with another great show. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.